Let's see. Holmes had Watson. The Lone Ranger had Tonto. Batman had Robin. Who did Namath had? Oh, he had Maynard. That's right. Don Maynard. I think you could make a case he is the most unappreciated New York sports legend ever. I don't know if he'd go along with that. He might quibble with it. He could take me down. I can see him right now. He's in
no,
good shape.
No, I think I'll agree with
you're
you.
You're
going to
go with that? The Hall of Famer made his name by being on the receiving end of Namath bullets in the Jets salad years, including, of course, the epic Super Bowl III. He's a four-time AFL All-Star, a five-time AFL selection on the All-Star team. He was, of course, he's in the Hall of Fame. Let's see. 88 touchdowns, 11,834 receiving yards, 633 receptions. He was the yin to Namath's yang. Broadway Joe was in pantyhose. Maynard stuck to his Levi's. He's still in them today. Namath was a media darling. Maynard didn't like reporters too much. Maybe he still doesn't. And maybe the feeling is mutual. I don't know. Namath lived the high life. Maynard's idea of fun as a teetotaler was a trip to the Statue of Liberty, a burger and a Coke with his wife. He's the real deal. He's from Oklahoma and Texas. And he's out with a great, fun memoir. And it's called You Can't Catch Sunshine. And he's here in the studio with me. It really is a pleasure to have you with me on the program.
Well, it's always great to come back to New York, I tell you.
Do you really mean that?
I really do. You know, it. When I first came as a rookie with the Giants, you know, and then you learn a little bit, and then you get involved and all. But the New Yorks were the greatest fans in the world, and I was real fortunate to play on the old with the New York Giants in the greatest game, sudden death game, and then over came the New York Titans and American Football League started in 60, and then they changed the name to the Jets when Sonny Werbel and his group took it over, and then the move to the Polo Grounds, to Shea Stadium, and some of the other great things in New York. And the fans, hey, they were great then, still are, and I had the pleasure of playing everywhere, kind of.
Well, let's back up just a little bit, because there's a lot to tell here when you talk about, you know, gosh, you know, just the greatest game ever played is a story, you know, which has been written about in pages and pages have been written. But why do they call you Sunshine? How did that get to be?
Well, that was a name given to me back in college, and because it had to do with a little building over, and I used to go over and help some people do some things. And my dad was a carpenter growing up, and I wound up doing a lot of extra work, you know, and it was, tell you the truth, the name of it was the Sunshine Nursery. And so the guy said, well, where's Maynard? Well, he's over there helping at the Sunshine Nursery. And one thing led to another, and then a little bit of it, they shortened some of it to Shine, but I liked it, and it stuck, and proud of it.
Now, you really did ride a mule to school. I understand it. Tell me about that. You grew up all over, right? You moved a lot. That's part of your story.
Right.
But you come from very humble beginnings, Oklahoma, you know, the classic work ethic kind of environment. Tell us a little bit about it.
Absolutely. My dad ran and managed some cotton gins. And early when I was born, near Lubbock and Texas Tech out there, well, my mom wound up in a TB sanatorium. So my older sister and older brother, we all three wound up in Oklahoma and lived with my grandparents till I was about six. And then she got out and we moved back. But while I was there, grandparents a lot of times, or even parents, send kids off to school as quick as they can get rid of them, maybe. And I started school when I was 5 years old. And I rode a mule 6 miles to a school. One-room school building, six rows. Each row was a grade and had one teacher. And that's the way it was. And that was part of my history, you know, not that I wanted to or anything, but it just happened.
It's quite, you know, it's larger than life for some of us who didn't grow up with mules. Tell us a little bit about, it was about that time, age five or six, you told your grandfather you never were going to touch alcohol. Well, how did a 5 or 6 year old even come to that?
Well, you know, I'm not quite sure, except I know granddad didn't drink, or maybe they didn't even have any drinking around too much at that time. And just one time he was sitting around, as he usually did. You know, when the sun went down, the lights went out except for a little old lantern. And you get to talking about things. And he said, you know, I don't want you to ever smoke, and I don't want you to ever drink. Well, I knew what smoking was a little bit by seeing people, but drinking, I really didn't know much about it. But somehow it just stuck in my mind, and I was fortunate to carry it on through life. And then I, with a few of my jet friends too, I kind of wound up being the designated driver before they ever had the term designated driver.
You were way ahead of your time. Yeah. Matter of fact, I was reading, speaking of way ahead of your time, you were driving a hybrid vehicle long before we coined that phrase. You had a propane-powered Ford. Tell me about that.
Well, my cousin up in Oklahoma there, they ran their tractors on propane, and he'd been over the Fort Bliss, and he drove back about 70 miles a day, and so he put propane on his vehicle. And because you get it out there on the farm real reasonable, it's probably about a third or even less than what gasoline fuel cost. So I always thought when I got older I was going to put a propane system on my car. And then my brother did before that. And then as I got old enough to drive and all, and then I got married, I got a 55 Ford, and I put propane on it. And it creates a good system of burning clean, and it makes your engine last longer. But you also have the advantage of dual fuel. You're driving down the road, you run out of propane, you just flick a switch, and now you run on gasoline. Wow. And then the only maybe inconvenience was that you more or less always had to buy your propane during the week. It wasn't available on the weekend, or some of the service stations out across the country, they never heard of propane on a vehicle.
Well, yeah, you get out of farm country, right? You still driving a propane vehicle?
Yes, sir.
No kidding. No
matter
kidding.
Of fact, I've even went a little step further on something. I put a propane enhancer unit on a diesel truck, and that is really unheard of.
Wow, but sounds like an afterburner or something.
A guy up in Oklahoma put it on, and what happens, it allows you, where fuel, you usually waste about 30% of it never gets really burned correctly. But on the diesel, which I bought that one year, they put it on, and now instead of the diesel will burn 99.6% of the diesel fuel, and you don't see any of that black smog and all that comes out when a diesel truck starts up.
You know, you are a guy who you marched your own drummer, and I assume you accept that as a compliment, right?
Oh, yes, sir.
Yeah. You know, the sideburns, the jeans. You showed up in New York initially for the Giants, and we can talk about the greatest game ever played. But the folks at the Giants were like, you know, trim the sideburns and take off the Levi's. And you said no, right?
Well, I didn't say it very loud. I just kind of
just
didn't
ignored
listen
it, huh?
Or ignored it would be the best word. I just kept them, you know. I didn't bother anybody, and I probably didn't say too many words my whole rookie year, you know, just tried to perform good. But now years later, you know, or somewhere down the line, they kind of, I think, named a program or a star after me, and they named him McLeod.
Well, you've got that speed. You originally ran track in high school, and that's what led you into football. Tell us about what it was like playing. Well, first of all, you had the offensive coordinator for the Giants when you showed up in 57 was a guy by the name of Lombardi, who I believe went on to some fame in football, right?
Oh, you bet. You know, what a great honor, to
have him as your offensive coordinator, right?
Right, and then I played a little defense also as a fifth back and ran punts and kickoffs back, so I had the privilege also to play under Tom Landry.
Defensive coordinator for that team was Tom Landry. Isn't that
right,
amazing?
Yeah, and then Lombardi, you know, I learned so much football from him, and then like great players like Kyle Rote and then Frank Gifford, the guy I idolized. But I knew those guys or knew about those guys back before they came to the Giants, when Kyle was at SMU and Gifford out at Southern Cal. And then one of my favorites that kind of took me in and helped me a lot on a personal basis was the great Emlyn Tennell as a defensive safety. But to play and be on that team was unbelievable.
And Em really took you under his wing, didn't he, when
yes,
you were
sir.
A rookie, which was unusual then. The veterans didn't talk to
him. It really
to
was. Rookies, you know, veterans didn't ever talk to him. And we trained out in Salem, Oregon at Willamette University.
I was trying to figure out why that was.
As I learned later, they played there, or they trained there for the weather and all, cool, comfortable, and get a lot done. And then they'd go down and play exhibition game with the 49ers, Frisco, and then the Rams in the other exhibition game, and they'd have two games in, and now they'd get ready to come back to New York and make the long trip.
So you're at the Giants, and 1958, that season comes along. Let's fast forward for the sake of brevity and take us set the scene for the greatest game ever played. For those who weren't alive then, that was actually a year before I was born, but I've read a lot about it. That was a game. It was the Giants versus the Colts, of course, and this was the Super Bowl of its time, the NFL championship.
Absolutely.
And what really set this one apart, besides the fact that it went into sudden death overtime, but it was televised, and it really brought the NFL into the mainstream of America, right?
It did. It just exploded, and it got so much interest, you know, and being the only pro game on the TV screen at that time, naturally everybody in the nation probably didn't have too much else to do, so they watched the football game, and then it came into the sudden death situation. And, you know, when they was trying to flip the coin and decide what to do, since the ball game's a tied ball game, it was real interesting to see the huddle that the referees had, their own huddle, trying to figure out exactly what to do.
This is uncharted territory, right?
Yeah.
So what do you remember most about that game?
Well, I just remember that they won the toss, and then they kicked off. And me being the guy that received the ball, well, I'm set a record, no big deal exactly, but I'm first man to ever touch the ball in an overtime game.
Put you in the history books. You're already there, but that gives you another claim to fame, right?
Right. But it went on. It was nip and tuck back and forth, we didn't go for the fourth down play. With Gifford thought he'd made it on that play, and then one of their great tackles, Geno Marcredi, broke his leg on that play. So we all, or the Giants, all the guys wanted to go for it on fourth down, but they wouldn't. They said, we're going to punt, and Don Chandler got off a great punt, put them all the way back on their 14-yard line. But with Unitas at the controls, here they came.
Johnny Unitas. You know, it was 3 yards and a cloud of dust stuff, right? He just handed off. He handed off, right? It was. And that's the interesting thing, because you, of course, made your name catching footballs. And you were there as the game changed. And, of course, now it's all passing now. Watching it now, it must be something for you to watch it.
I tell you, it's, you know, if you sneeze, you may miss a play.
Well, so you didn't return to the Giants. That's kind of a long story. We won't get into that one. But basically, you know, Vince Lombardi went on to the Packers and fame there and new coach, and you move on. And all of a sudden you sign on. You were the first draft choice of the New York then Titans.
Right.
Which, of course, became the Jets. Fast forward to Joe Namath coming into the picture. There was a friendship there, and there was a bond on the field as well, correct?
Well, it really was. You know, Joe got a great salary, and that helped a lot of other people, not only just on our club but around the league. But the other great part of it from my standpoint was that I had played – at that time, I had played with over 25 professional quarterbacks. And so I told Joe, I said, well, I'm glad you're here. We're going to sit down. We're going to talk and work on every play and just make it a real perfection on how we'll do it. And I'd learned under the great Sammy Ball, the passing game that was unbelievable. And along with George Sauer and Bake Turner and Pete Lammons and myself, we had four receivers. And I like to plug this. We had one busted play in 9 years.
Isn't that amazing?
But as we tuned up and fine-tuned and everything in the passing game, I told Joseph, I said, I'm going to make you a better quarterback, and you're going to make me a great receiver. So it worked out pretty good.
Takes two to tango. Now, you were sort of famous for just not running a pattern necessarily, just getting open, right?
Well, I had a little publicity from that standpoint of some of the sports people that really didn't understand the passing attack. And we had a procedure and a rule how we broke patterns or changed at the line of scrimmage. But a lot of times people didn't understand that, and I got a little bad knock on that situation. But I never I never ran wrong patterns. I ran them the way we had them designed and adjusted to. And Joe was great at making the different read or the different change. And me, if I wanted to break my pattern, I'd raise my hand and he'd see it and he'd know I was going to the second part of the pattern. And if Joe wanted to break the pattern, he just pumped the ball at me and didn't throw it. And that told me to go into the second part of the pattern.
So there's a lot more going on there than we knew.
Oh, yeah. It was designed that way, but a lot of people just didn't know it. And like I say, you have one busted play, and then they think you've been doing that all the time.
So, my read of him is very different personality from yours.
Well, Joe was single and so forth, and he had a single life, and I was married and all. But at the same time, in a very truthful statement, we had two or three guys that put Joe in the shade as far as being kind of swingers, you might say.
He was conservative, right? By comparison. Huh?
And it was always interesting as I went to different places and guy read and heard about names, said, what's he really like? And I said, well, I always measure up Joe as a great quarterback, but the nightlife you read about him, you can divide it. He really wasn't that much. But as a football player and a quarterback, whatever you've read and heard about his ability, you need to multiply it.
Really, really. Was he as talented a quarterback as you have ever played with?
Oh yeah, I think so. And the great thing that Joe released the ball so quick, and he got rid of it, and he had the strength to go with it. And because he had knee problems a little bit in college and then later on up with us a little bit, he knew that he had one job to do, and that was to hand off, call the plays, and then in the passing game, we'll get back deep. And I said, you get back there 10 or 12 yards, and then you throw it. And that way you'll have plenty of time to get rid of it before them big guys that come after you.
Yeah, he needed to unload that ball because those knees weren't going to last. Hey, is it true you catch the football with one eye closed?
Well, in a drill that I kind of designed or came up with, you get out early, you do extra stretching, and I'm an old track guy, so I got a lot of extra stretching that I did because of track just to keep myself healthy. But you play some, you get your roommate, teammate, Bake Turner and I roomed together for several years, but we'd play catch with one eye shut, just because where you're sitting now, you can look to your left, and you may not see, you can't see anything with your right eye. So when you catch the ball from the left, I was on the right-hand side as a receiver, and I'd turn in real quick. Well, a lot of times you'll catch a ball with one eye, even though you may not know it. So if you kind of play that catch with one eye shut, five to the left high, five to the right high, and over to the right low, and so on, then you kind of get in the habit of catching some balls that's kind of low and hard to catch anyway. And if you do it with one eye shut, that'll kind of make you look it in just a split second longer than maybe you need to.
It's like putting blinders on that mule you rode or something.
Yeah,
something
hey,
like that.
You bet. Keeps you going down the right path.
We're talking with number 13, Don Maynard. You Can't Catch Sunshine. I can't say that, but You Can't Catch Sunshine is his memoir and takes you back to that those glory years. Had a piece of the greatest game ever played, as they called it, 1958, Giants versus Baltimore Colts, Yankee Stadium. And then, of course, Super Bowl III. I mean, that they say the greatest game ever played. Super Bowl III, you think it trumps it?
Not really. I think, they're just two great games.
Same level, maybe.
Right. And the different attendance of people that watched may not have seen the original game. And Frank Gifford wrote a great story about it, and those guys were there. But now, as time keep marching on, we see a lot of new stuff,
Well, remind people, for those who weren't around then, I remember it well. I was 9 years old and rabid football fan, and it was, the Jets were just complete upstarts. Baltimore was the machine. Remind, and there, here Joe Namath was saying, we're going to beat you.
Right.
That was saying something, right?
Well, it really was. The Colts, like I say, I think they'd won about 13 games along about that time. But we respected the Colts naturally, but we knew what a great team we really had and didn't have quite that much publicity. We had a great running attack with Boozer and Snell, and the offensive line was great. And then we had four receivers that was outstanding. And then we had the number one defense in the year in 67. And then we had the number one defense 68, and then later it turned out 69 too. But we those guys weren't scared of anybody, and we respected them, but we came to play. And at the same time, I always kid people and say, we didn't have nothing to lose. You know, they picked them to win. All we got to do is show up, and we're going to get the loser share in the Super Bowl. And if we'll play a little harder, we'll get the winner share.
Do you remember what the winner share was?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the losers were $7,500. Somebody asked me what the losers was. I kidded them. I said, I don't know. But we got $15,000, and that worked out good. Plus, we got to play the college all-star the coming next summer. We played the college all-stars out in Chicago, and we won that one. And, golly, that's a old hard field. It must have rained and dried, and nobody manicured it or anything.
Well, what's when Joe Namath in the run-up to Super Bowl III was talking about how we're going to beat the Colts, did you say, hey, Joe, you know, take it easy, you know? We'd rather not raise expectations too much.
Well, you know, really, we didn't pay any attention to it because we'd been watching the film for about 2 weeks. You trade out certain films, and we all just commented back and forth, going back and forth to meetings about what they were doing, and defense said, well, we're going to intercept about four passes, and the offense said, well, we're going to score. We got, you know, good balanced attack, and we'll sure show up, that's for sure.
And what do you remember most about being in that game?
Well, about the third play of the second series, Joe checked off to a go pattern for myself. And I beat the zone coverage short and deep, and I was about 5 yards behind everybody, and the ball was about an inch too long. But it scared them enough that they doubled and tripled my side the rest of the game. So I knew I wasn't going to catch any more passes, so I just went to the wide side of the field, got as far as out as I could to spread them out, and then Joe went to Sauer. He set a record in the game, and I might have set some kind of record. I had the best seat in the house. I didn't catch any passes, but late in the third quarter, I caught one on the end zone. It was out of the end zone by about a foot or about 6 inches, and that would have maybe gave me a score. But
hey, it's an honor to be triple-teamed. Quickly, you still doing 31 sit-ups in bed every morning?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
All right.
I got to get my heart going somehow.
You look like $1 million. Don Maynard, really a pleasure. You Can't Catch Sunshine is the name of his memoir. If you were live then and you're a football fan, you got to read it. And if you weren't, you need to understand what it was all about back then. It was a different game. It really was. And really, that changed football forever. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. And hello to all the great fans in New York.
And you're doing a book signing. Where's the signing? You know?
I apologize.
It's tomorrow at 7 o'clock at Bookends in Ridgewood, New Jersey. Wednesday at noon at Borders on 100 Broadway. And then 7 o'clock at Books and Greetings in Northvale, New Jersey. You're a busy guy.
Well, I hope so.
All right, details are on the show page at WNYC.org.